You are tuned into All Together Now, the evening collaborative news show from many WGXC producers. Today behind me, we're listening to the sound of the wave farm ponds, microphones at the bottom of the ponds, hydrophones, listening to the weather. Today we'll hear New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's speech from June 22nd in Staten Island about the state's response to heroin addiction. We've got other reports from Workers Independent News and a Green News report. The song of the day is The Cuckoo Bird from Tom Carter, who performs June 23rd tonight at the Half Moon in Hudson on All Together Now, your collaborative local news show.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you a special news bulletin.
Stay tuned to this station.
Stand by for news.
Direct via satellite from our on-the-spot task force.
Good evening from our newsroom in New York.
This is
Daily News and Weather Report.
We take you now to
this radio broadcast.
You are tuned in to All Together Now, a collaborative one-hour news show for community radio stations in the Capital Region and New York's Hudson Valley. All Together Now features contributions from the public, along with programmers at WOOC in Troy and WGXC in Accra, featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for Thursday, June the 23rd, 2016. I'm Philip Grant. Katie Kosajansky is reporting in the Daily Mail that the Greene County Legislature will select a construction manager for the proposed new county jail next month. Four potential candidates will be interviewed by the Jail Construction Committee beginning July the 7th. BBL Construction Services of Albany, Turner Construction Company of New York City, Gilbane Building Company of Providence, Rhode Island, and the Pike Company of Clifton Park in Saratoga County have all formally indicated interest in the project. Greene County Jail Superintendent Mike Spitz said, and I quote, "I called all of the county jail administrators and no one said anything negative about any of the companies," end quote. Greene County Administrator Sean Groden said everyone on the list has municipal building experience, and some have more experience building jails than others. Legislators will hold a special session July 14th to discuss the interview results and decide the next steps in the project. You can read that full story in the Daily Mail. Greg Hudson is reporting in the Daily Mail that Hunter Town officials and law enforcement continue to look for a solution to the parking problem on Platte Clove Road. At the Hunter Town Board meeting on Wednesday, June the 22nd, Town Board member David Cuckle said, and I quote, "It's getting rather hairy out there," end quote. Cuckle said the road is narrow and has no viable shoulder area and cannot safely accommodate parked cars while providing safe passage for emergency vehicles. Huntertown Police Sergeant Robert Haynes told the board that the section of Platte Clove Road near the parking area that is owned and managed by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation needs to be posted as no parking on both sides of the road. Haynes said the parking issue is especially bad on weekends, even when there are no organized events taking place in town. Law enforcement and town board members are planning a visit to the site sometime before the next board meeting on July 19th. You can read that full story in the Daily Mail. Chris Bragg is reporting at Capital Confidential that Governor Andrew Cuomo said on Wednesday, June the 22nd, that he does not believe holding a special session later this year to close the so-called LLC loophole or to restrict lawmakers' outside income would be productive. Cuomo said it would be futile to call them back and believes the only way to implement the changes is with a constitutional convention. Cuomo said, and I quote, "There's no point in calling them back because the measures they didn't do, they don't want to do," end quote. The Times Union reported this week that so far, not much progress has been made in building momentum for a constitutional convention. You can read that full story at Capital Confidential, a Times Union blog. Now here's Andrea Sears from the Public News Service reporting on the decline in the incarceration rates.
States that reduce their prison populations are seeing their crime rates go down, too. In the 1990s, getting tough on crime led to a rapid rise in the number of people incarcerated. Now, with more than 2 million people behind bars, the United States has the largest prison population in the world. But according to James Cullen with the Brennan Center for Justice, a new state-by-state analysis of data from 2006 to 2014 shows reversing that trend doesn't increase crime.
Not only is it possible for states to lower incarceration and crime, but actually most states are already doing it. And that's important because it really shows us a pathway forward to solving mass incarceration.
27 states have reduced both incarceration and crime rates, including New York, where the prison population declined by 18% and crime fell by 17%. California reduced its incarceration rate by 27% with an almost equal drop in crime. But as Cullen points out, similar results have been achieved in states such as Texas and South Carolina.
So you're not just seeing a few states that you often think of as at the forefront of reforms, but you're seeing states that you wouldn't think about not only reforming, but reforming and staying safe, too.
Two out of three states that increased their prison populations in the same time period saw crime rates increase as well. The 1994 federal crime bill gave funding to states to increase incarceration, and the prison population exploded. Cullen says the Brennan Center is proposing legislation it calls the Reverse Mass Incarceration Act.
And the idea is the federal government portioning off $20 billion over 10 years, giving funding to states that are able to lower incarceration and crime. And we know from history that states are going to respond to those incentives.
Cullen notes that the Brennan Center analysis shows reducing crime and the prison population is not only possible, it's already happening. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
Now here's Andrea Sears from the Public News Service reporting on the thriving eagle population.
New York's bald eagle population is on the rebound. Monday was National American Eagle Day, and for the second year in a row, three bald eagle fledglings have taken flight in the Nature Conservancy's Meshomek Preserve on Shelter Island. Mike Scheibel, manager of the preserve, says that is real cause for celebration.
We are witnessing one of the most remarkable conservation success stories of our time, due in large part to the removal of DDT from widespread agricultural use.
DDT, a potent insecticide that interferes with birds' ability to reproduce, was banned in 1972. 50 years ago, bald eagles had all but disappeared from New York. According to Scheibel, back then, the eggs laid by a nesting pair near Hemlock Lake in upstate New York were no longer hatching.
By 1965, it was the last known bald eagle nest in New York State. So we're essentially down to nothing. One pair of eagles that was experiencing continued nesting failure.
In 1976, the Department of Environmental Conservation began bringing young birds in from other states to rebuild the population, and there are now an estimated 350 nesting pairs in the state. Scheibel likes to point out that groundbreaking work that made the connection between DDT and declining bird populations was done on Long Island.
I think the lesson is that it's good to think globally, as they say, but it's a reminder to us all that conservation can and does start locally.
The Nature Conservancy has preserved bald eagle habitat and protected waters that eagles depend on for food throughout New York State. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
David Lee reports in the Columbia paper that on June the 12th, New Lebanon debuted a new playground at the Shatford Park Pavilion on State Route 22 in Lebanon Springs. Linda Hersa, a local entrepreneur and community activist, found out last year that Steventown Elementary School was being sold and was giving away the playground equipment for free to anyone who could remove it from its concrete foundation. Town officials and volunteers went to work to remove and reinstall the equipment in the Columbia County town. At the playground dedication, New Lebanon Town Supervisor Colleen Teef said, and I quote, "I know New Lebanon. We may not have a lot of money, but we have dedicated residents," end quote. You can read that full story in the Columbia paper. And that wraps up the WGXC Hands-On Radio Daily News and Weather Report for today, Thursday, the 23rd day of June, 2016. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
National Weather Service in Albany predicts a mostly clear night with a low around 51. Friday should be sunny with a high near 79.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Following a day of multiple protest rallies in the streets, what's next for the Chicago Teachers Union and their battle to fully fund Chicago schools? CTU Vice President Jesse Sharkey says both the union and the community are engaged in a struggle to defend and fully fund public education in Chicago, and cuts to education are unacceptable.
If they try to come to us with cuts, we'll strike against those cuts. We'll strike to defend the schools if it comes to that in the fall. So, you know, at which point they're going to have a difficult choice, which is that if they want the schools to open, they want the city to function with public schools, they're going to have to figure out a way to fund it. We are not going to sit idly by and watch them cut the schools to ribbons.
Sharkey says Governor Bruce Rauner's bid to impose his agenda on the state legislature by blocking a state budget is an impediment to finding a funding solution for Chicago schools.
Yeah, that's a real impediment. I think what it means for Rahm and the local, you know, Chicago elite is that they're not the people who are calling the shots. They're really stuck in the middle, and they're stuck in the middle between a public and a union that wants schools preserved and doesn't want to see cuts, and a governor who is not interested in helping solve the problem at all.
Allina Health is spending an estimated $25 million on scab workers during the nurses' strike there, more money than Allina says it will save by demanding nurses change their health care plans. Allina has said it expects to save $10 million by forcing nurses to go to an inferior health plan with higher deductibles and out-of-pocket costs. Nurses say they're striking over health care, staffing issues, and the quality of patient care. More than 6,000 Atlantic City casino workers will strike July 1st if no agreement is reached on a new contract. The workers represented by Unite Here, including at Trump Taj Mahal, want a pay raise above their current average of just $11.74 an hour. According to Unite Here, the workers have given up more than $40 million through wage freezes and benefits cuts over the past 5 years. The union says Atlantic City casinos are flush with their best year in nearly a decade, in total a $2.5 billion a year business.
Brought to you by Union Active, your certified iOS and Android mobile app developer, offering high-quality, union-made mobile apps backed by a support team which upgrades your product to every new mobile operating system. Features, pricing, and examples are online at unionactive.com.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays, noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
First interview tonight is a speech from Governor Andrew Cuomo from yesterday, June 22nd, in Staten Island, talking about the state's new response to heroin addiction.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Pleasure to be back on Staten Island. And, you know, I have three daughters. I can't imagine the pain of losing a child. It really is just unimaginable. It's unnatural. We have losses in life. We lose parents, brothers, sisters, but there's a sequence, there's a cycle to life. It's unnatural to lose a child. And that you took that pain and you put it into a positive place speaks so highly of you and who you are and your character and your integrity and your strength. That you have the admiration of every person in this room. And, you know, I believe God does everything for a reason. And Your loss, I believe, will save other parents and literally save them from going through the pain and literally will save lives. And you have all of our gratitude for that. Anne Marie Parada. It's a pleasure to be with my colleague, Senator Lanza, who really is one of the finest people in the New York State Legislature. You are lucky to have him. I hate to say that in front of him because he then uses it against me later on. But it's true. He is in the business for all the right reasons. He's total integrity. He works hard. And it's always about making a difference in his community. And it is that simple, the formula to do public service right. And he does public service right. Senator Lanza, pleasure to be with him. Assemblyman Michael Cusick has been a friend for a long time. He is the real deal. He's a young star. He's on the rise. Let's give him a round of applause. And all my other colleagues from the Assembly and the Senate who are here today, they're all looking much better than the last time I saw them, because the last time I saw them, they were in Albany. And they were at the end of the legislative session. And the way it works in Albany is the legislative session goes from January to June. And you're going up and down, back and forth to Albany, and you're missing home, and you're missing meals, and you're missing love. So towards the end of the session, everyone gets a little gray-looking and a little ornery, let's say. But now they've been home for a week, and they're looking much happier, and they're looking much healthier. We also had a very good legislative session overall. We accomplished a lot of good things for the people, a lot of national precedents that New York accomplished, which are now literally going nationwide. We have the best paid family leave program in the United States of America, and we passed that right here. More funding for education than the state has ever committed before, almost $25 billion. We are the first state in the United States to require that every school tests its water for lead. First state of New York. We just passed legislation against what they call zombie properties. Zombie properties are the properties that are abandoned and wind up deteriorating and take down the whole neighborhood. And that's finally done. And we did that here in the state of New York. And something that I always make a little money on the side with. New York State just cut taxes for the middle class defined up to 300,000, lowest tax rate in 70 years. In the state of New York. The way I make money on that is I bet everybody I see, do you think New York State raised taxes or lowered taxes? And everybody says raise taxes, right? Because you just can't conceive of government actually lowering taxes. But we did. And the lowest rate in 70 years is actually something to talk about. So we had a great session overall. But I think the most impactful thing we did is this policy on heroin. I believe this will literally save lives. And it is the product of a lot of people who worked very hard. We had a joint task force between the Senate and the Assembly. They went all across the state having hearings. I was here with Senator Lanza and Assemblyman Cusick at the hearing on Staten Island. Anne Marie, your story, the story of parents who lost children, story of providers, were so compelling. The task force did an extraordinary report, and it was frightening to read the report because the numbers are increasing exponentially. Senator Lanza mentioned 3,000 hospital visits Staten Island. 10 years ago, this wasn't a problem. 10 years ago, you had 7, 8 deaths on Staten Island. Last year we had 80, and the numbers are just doubling and tripling all across the state. It's not just this state, it's happening all across the country. You want to get a scope of the severity of this problem. We now lose more people to heroin opioid overdoses as we did to AIDS at its peak, believe it or not. AIDS at its peak. And it's grown so gradually that people haven't really taken notice. It does not discriminate. It's black children, it's white children, it's brown children, it's rich children, it's poor children, it's urban, it's suburban. It is a drug that is more accessible than any other drug. Most of the addictions start with a prescription painkiller. And you start with a painkiller, and you're on it for a protracted period of time, and then you can't get off, or somebody gives you some of the prescription medication. And the numbers are just going up, up, and up. So New York State had the task force. We came up with a comprehensive plan. We're about to sign the legislation. First thing the legislation does is it takes on the insurance companies. Why? The insurance companies have been a hurdle and an obstacle in the beginning of this process. Now, the insurance companies, I was the attorney general before I was the governor, and I sued the insurance companies all the time. Not because I'm an especially litigious fellow, but the insurance companies are in the business of healthcare. They are businesses. They are not charities. They're not your friend. They're not your uncle. They're not your doctor. They are in the business of providing insurance, which means if they don't have to provide it, they don't want to provide it because it's expensive. And what's happening now is too many times the decisions are made by the insurance company. And when you have a person who is on heroin or on a drug and they're ready to go into treatment, they have to go right then. And you have so many cases of a parent who has a child who needs treatment, and the insurance company says, well, we're not ready to approve, or we want a second opinion, or we want him or her to look at our doctor. And the insurance company and the delay of the insurance company literally has cost lives, in my opinion. This state is going to do something never done before. The decision to give treatment for heroin or opioids is not going to be left up to the insurance company. It's going to be made by a doctor, and the insurance company is going to do what the doctor says rather than vice versa. And it is a very simple system. The state is going to set up a medical protocol. The doctor will answer the questions. If the doctor answers those questions and it says that person needs treatment, that person is going to get the treatment, and that insurance company is going to have to pay for the treatment, period. That's the first thing we did in this legislation. Second, if you have a child, once that child hits 18 years old, you don't have the right to involuntarily institutionalize the child. And the current law is they can only be held 48 hours against their will. And you have a lot of parents and a lot of medical professionals who will say 48 hours is too short. Because in 48 hours, the person, even if they are now clean for 48 hours, they haven't stabilized. And if you let the person out after 48 hours, there's a very high chance that they're going to go right back to where they were, redo exactly what they were doing. On the other hand, it was controversial because you also have a civil liberties question. The person is over 18 years old, and you're holding a person against their will. Medical professionals said the right amount of time is the increase from 48 hours to 72 hours, and that's what this law does. You can hold a person for 72 hours. It's for their own good. I'm comfortable that it's not an invasion on their civil rights. If a doctor says their health requires us to hold them for 72 hours, then hold them for 72 hours, and that's what this law is going to do. Third, our medical professions and our pharmacists are truly a part of this issue. They have been writing prescriptions for more painkillers than people need. My 20-year-old, a couple of months ago, had her tonsils out, came home with a 30-day supply of opioids for having her tonsils out. You take opioids for 30 days, there's a good chance you're starting to have a problem when you quit. You give somebody a 30-day supply, that is a very valuable supply that they can actually sell. This law says no more 30-day prescriptions. No prescription will be written longer than 7 days. If you have to refill it, you refill it, but nothing longer than 7 days. And the fourth piece is treatment. You cannot force a person into treatment. It doesn't work. Unless a person is ready to accept the treatment, unless a person believes they need the treatment, you can't make them go into treatment. But when a person is ready to go, when a person hits bottom, when a person knows that they need help, then you have to strike when the iron is hot. And you have to get that person into treatment right then and there. That you have a window of opportunity when the person says, I get it, I need help. And you want to seize that window because it could be gone the next day. Too many times, people call for treatment, and the treatment center says, well, we have no beds now. Call back in 30 days. Call back in 30 days. The person could be dead in 30 days, or the person could just be in a different mindset. We need more treatment slots in the state of New York. This is going to increase treatment. 2,500 more slots will be funded by this bill, so we'll have the treatment we need. And we'll have both day treatment as well as residential treatment, so depending on the condition of the person, they can get the treatment. That is a comprehensive program that gives us the tools we need. But let me end where Senator Lanza started. It comes down to the word leadership. And he was very kind to me. But the truth is, I've been in government a long time. And government, you can tell what the government is all about in the way it responds to a crisis. Because that's when you really need government to function. I don't care if it's Hurricane Sandy, or if it's 9/11, or if it's terrorism. That's when you really need government to function. And there's no excuses. It either comes together and it works, or it doesn't. And in this case, your state government came together and worked.
This is the WGXC News Update. I'm Alana Medlock. Perry Teasdale in the Columbia Paper reports that this coming Tuesday is Election Day. June 28th, primary election voters will pick which two candidates will compete to replace Chris Gibson, Republican from Kinderhook, in the fall election for New York's 19th Congressional District. John Faso of Kinderhook and Andrew Heaney of Millbrook in Dutchess County are on Republican ballots, and Zephyr Teachout of Dover Plains in Dutchess County and Will Yandick in the town of Livingston in Columbia County are on Democratic ballots. There is information about the candidates available on our newsroom page at wgxc.org/newsroom. Polls are open from noon to 9 p.m. on June 28th. Read the full story in the Columbia paper.
The first major overhaul of the Federal Toxic Substances Control Act is now law.
President Obama signed the legislation Wednesday, vastly expanding the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to test and regulate the thousands of chemicals in daily use. Liz Hitchcock with Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families calls that a significant improvement.
The federal government now has the authority to take action on toxic chemicals that it has not had.
The original law, passed in 1976, made the cost of regulation a major consideration and set standards for scientific proof of harm that were so high the EPA was even blocked from regulating asbestos. Unable to regulate, the agency tried setting voluntary limits on the use of some compounds, including PFOA, the suspected carcinogen found in the drinking water in Hoosick Falls, New York. The law now makes health and environmental considerations the sole criteria for regulation, a change Hitchcock thinks might have made a big difference 40 years ago.
We could hope that EPA would have regulated PFOA and prevented the health hazards now being experienced in communities all over the country.
The new law requires the EPA to test 10 chemicals a year initially, expanding to 20 a year once protocols are established. But there are some 80,000 chemicals sold in the United States. Hitchcock says that means the pace will be very slow, but if the EPA gives known harmful substances the highest priority, it will make a real difference.
If we can take action on even a small number of chemicals that have a big health effect, we can affect the lives of millions of Americans.
But Hitchcock also criticizes the new law for putting restrictions on the ability of states to impose their own regulations on harmful chemicals. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
WTEN News 10 in Albany reports that last week, the New York Department of Environmental Conservation sent formal surveys to more than 150 facilities that may have used the PFOA chemical that is tied to drinking water poisoning in two Rensselaer County towns. Many fire departments, airports, and other facilities that may have used the related chemical, PFOS, in firefighting foam were also sent formal surveys, all due for return by July 15th. Vermont and New Hampshire started similar statewide surveys earlier this spring. Read the full story on WTEN's website. This has been the WGXC News Update.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global, unembedded, independent, international investigative news hour, broadcasting live every weekday morning at 8 here on WGXC 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties.
I'm Philip Gray, one of the contributors to All Together Now. Listen to Democracy Now! In the morning and All Together Now! In the evening, WGXC's collaborative hour-long news show at 6 p.m., featuring local and regional news, weather updates, and newsmaker interviews on WGXC 90.7 FM, listener-supported hands-on radio.
Democracy Now! At 8.
All Together Now! At 6 p.m.
here on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Next, we have these reports.
It's Thursday, June 23, 2016.
In a momentous decision, Pacific Gas and Electric announced it will not pursue license renewal for the two reactors at the Diablo Canyon nuclear site near San Luis Obispo.
Lights out for the last nuclear power plant in California. Judge strikes down new rules for fracking on public lands. Study finds high levels of toxic chemicals in the bodies of people living near fracking sites. Plus, researchers in Iceland figure out how to turn carbon emissions into stone.
Really? Rock on! All of those stories and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It can get so hot, you can actually fry an egg right on the sidewalk.
Yeah, that's how hot it... Wait, why are we using eggs to tell temperature? I don't understand this. Like, people in Africa are watching this going, we would never do that in Africa, huh? We don't do such things, and we don't like wasting food. And also, we don't have sidewalks. Yeah, that is part of it.
This is your Green News Report.
Because we call them pavements, you racists. That's why.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, before you get to today's Green News Report, just a quick thanks to those who have stopped by bradblog.com/donate to celebrate our 700th episode of the Green News Report the other day. Thank you to everyone who has done that. To those of you who haven't, what's the holdup? Now that it's our 701st episode, I guess it doesn't actually matter.
Well, here goes 701.
Get to it.
The last nuclear power plant in California, the Diablo Canyon Nuclear Generating Station south of San Francisco, will be phased out by 2025 under a joint agreement announced on Tuesday between the plant owner, Pacific Gas and Electric, plus labor and environmental groups. It's primarily due to the plant's proximity to numerous earthquake fault lines of particular concern after the Fukushima nuclear plant disaster. PG&E said it will replace the plant's 9% share of the state's electricity with renewable energy, but closing the plant won't help in the fight against global warming since it will be swapping one source of carbon-free electricity for another rather than closing fossil fuel sources.
Well, this is very cool news. No more nuclear plants in California once this shuts down. Of course, the shutdown of these plants takes how long?
Decades and billions.
Decades and billions. So even when we shut down these nuclear plants, we are still stuck with them forever.
That's true. Plus, some environmentalists are concerned about closing down nuclear generating stations because they believe that we won't be able to cut carbon emissions fast enough to avoid catastrophic climate change without using nuclear energy.
Silly environmentalists.
Two developments related to fracking. A new study has detected high levels of toxic chemicals used in fracking in the bodies of people living in heavily fracked Pavilion, Wyoming. While other studies have focused on water pollution impacts of fracking, this was the first study to analyze fracking air pollution impacts, studying residents who live nearby, finding that they have a higher amount of 8 toxic chemicals, including benzene and other carcinogens, in their urine than the general population. In a setback for the Obama administration, a federal judge this week struck down new federal rules proposed to regulate the controversial natural gas drilling technique on the grounds that the Interior Department does not have the authority to regulate fracking on public lands. Neither does the EPA, for that matter. That's thanks to a special carve-out for the fracking industry in the 2005 Safe Drinking Water Act, passed during the Bush administration, in which the Republican majority in Congress explicitly excluded hydraulic fracturing operations on public lands from federal regulation. California has 66 million dead trees. That's according to a new assessment by the U.S. Forest Service this week. It's a bad sign for a state already mired in an epic 5-year drought and already battling an intense and early wildfire season. The Forest Service blames the historic tree die-off on severe drought, a dramatic rise in bark beetle infestation, and overall hotter temperatures thanks to global warming. In a statement, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, who oversees the Forest Service, again urged Congress to please increase the Forest Service firefighting budget as he has requested every summer since taking office. Finally, researchers in Iceland have found a new way of tackling climate change by storing carbon dioxide emissions underground where it turns to stone. Literally, turns out that CO2 dissolved in water reacts chemically with a specific type of volcanic rock called basalt, of which Iceland has plenty. The CO2 reacts with the basalt to form carbonate minerals, literally mineralizing into limestone in about 2 years. Now, this is only a pilot project, and it's expensive and requires water and volcanic rock. But if it can be scaled up, it could be a breakthrough solution to capturing carbon emissions.
Thank you, Desi Doyen. You are the basalt of the earth. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Don't forget you can download our reports anytime via Stitcher, TuneIn, or iTunes. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Unhappy about something you heard on All Together Now? Or maybe you have a strong opinion about an issue. Energy, agriculture, the environment, the Common Core standards, or broadband access. Don't keep it to yourself. Call 518-291-9492 and leave a 3-minute message, and we'll play it on the air. Leave a 3-minute message, 518-291-9492, with your take for all you hear. Again, that number is 518-291-9492. To leave a 3-minute message that may be played on All Together Now. Thanks for getting involved in your local community.
Florist from Palinville and their song Cool and Refreshing from the album Holdly is our bonus song of the day.
I'm so terrified of all the things I love. I know that I will lose them all, one by one. But that's not what I think about when I look into the sky. I see sunlight that is blinding and it just hurts my eyes. And I'm trying to be fine, but I lie about the things I say will never die, like memories, forgiveness, and the light inside my eyes. It's terrifying. It's totally fine. Think of me by the creek in cut-off jeans, holding on to something that has meaning to me. Well, I don't really think my life will ever make me as happy as Catterskill Creek. And I'm trying to be good, but I'm done. No way, just kidding, I'm not. 'Cause I still have that feeling of water above my knees. It's cool and refreshing, and that won't fade away.
National headlines from Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service Daily Newscast for Thursday, June the 23rd, 2016. I'm Mike Clifford. In focus on our nationwide rundown, Democrats lead a gun control sit-in on the House floor. A federal judge delivers a blow to the Obama administration's fracking rules, and the Supreme Court poised to decide an affirmative action case.
No bill, no break! No! Topping our news, no bill, no break. That was the chant from House Democrats following the lead of Georgia Representative John Lewis as they staged a sit-in on the House floor demanding that a gun control measure come to a vote. Late in the evening, Democrats broke into song on the House floor with the civil rights anthem, We Shall Overcome. Speaker Paul Ryan dismissed the sit-in as a publicity stunt, while a number of Democrats plan to bed down in the chamber so they can occupy the House again today. In a blow to the Obama administration's environmental agenda, a federal judge struck down the Bureau of Land Management's fracking rules late Tuesday. Suzanne Potter tells us the judge ruled that the president overstepped his authority.
The judge ruled that the agency needs permission from Congress to regulate fracking and noted that legislators previously denied the EPA the right to regulate the practice under the Clean Water Act. Claire Lakewood, an attorney with the Center for Biological Diversity, says that argument doesn't hold up.
It's an outlier of a decision, frankly. There is plenty of authority that BLM has the authority to make rules with regard to fossil fuel extraction on its lands, including fracking, and we are confident that this will be overturned on appeal.
The rules were already on hold after the same judge issued a preliminary injunction last year. The case was brought by several oil and gas producing states and a Native American tribe who argued that the rules were unnecessary since the states already have the authority to regulate fracking.
Methane is a potent greenhouse gas leaked by hydraulic fracturing and other oil gas production. Mark Richardson has the details from a new report that pinpoints the who's who of methane pollution in Texas and throughout the United States.
According to the Center for American Progress, 11 companies emitted half of the methane pollution from onshore oil and gas production in 2014, more than 48 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. Crystal Hennigan, Texas field organizer for Moms Clean Air Force, says regulatory agencies in Texas aren't doing much to solve the problem, leaving it up to producers.
We haven't been able to rely on individual companies to take these leaks on aggressively as far as detecting them and plugging them. So far, it's just been voluntary, and here in Texas, I believe less than 1% have done that.
The report says there are more than 180,000 wells across Texas, which it conservatively estimates emit over 16 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year. It also notes that volatile organic compounds and other toxins often leak along with methane, worsening air quality and contributing to climate change.
The Environmental Protection Agency recently finalized limits on methane emissions from new sources, and there are calls for the agency to also set standards for wells and equipment already in operation. Hiring private companies for government work is not a panacea. Mary Sherman reports that's what some groups are saying in reaction to the latest lawsuit filed in the Flint water crisis.
The civil suit announced Wednesday by Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette alleges two firms hired to help mitigate the lead contamination actually made the crisis worse. Lonnie Scott with Progress Michigan contends the suit is a prime example of the failure of the government's lowest bidder approach.
This shows that privatization doesn't work. We've seen with the Flint water crisis that emergency management doesn't work and that fiscal austerity policies don't work. It's been a disaster for our local communities.
The companies named in the lawsuit, Volia and Lockwood Andrews and Newnam, denied the allegations. Criminal charges were filed against two state environmental leaders in April for their roles in the crisis, and Schuette says more charges could be coming from the ongoing criminal investigation.
On Tuesday, Flint's mayor said several bids to replace the city's water lines have been submitted, but were all much higher than anticipated. The office is reviewing the proposals before deciding how to proceed. And finally, the future of affirmative action policies at North Carolina universities could be determined by a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Stephanie Carson has our report.
As early as this week, the court is expected to rule on a case challenging the admission policy at the University of Texas in Austin, which includes race as a factor in the admission of some of their students. Depending on how the eight justices rule, it could have an impact on the policy at the University of North Carolina, which also considers race in its admissions process. Mark Dorison at the UNC's Center for Civil Rights says it's important the high court preserve diversity.
Diversity among the student body is a valuable and critical educational tool. It's a component of education that is particularly vital as our country grows more diverse.
A similar case challenging UNC's admissions policy is pending in the court system, but it was stayed pending the outcome of the Texas case. Because the court is evenly numbered, a deadlocked decision would let the ruling of a lower court, which ruled in favor of the affirmative action policy, stand.
The state of California banned affirmative action back in 1998, and since then, Hispanic and Black enrollment have decreased. A similar outcome was seen in Michigan, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. That's our news for now. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
National Weather Service in Albany predicts a mostly clear night with a low around 51. Friday should be sunny with a high near 79 and a low around 53. Saturday should be sunny too with a high near 82 and a low around 55. And then Sunday should also be sunny with a high near 85 and a low around 60. You're listening to 90.7 WGXC Acra. In the community calendar tonight, Laurie Goldston performing at the Dreamaway Lodge in Beckett, Massachusetts. That's at 8:30 p.m. At 9, Tom Carter's playing at the Half Moon in Hudson. Friday, there's a Hudson Historic Preservation Commission meeting at 10 a.m. at Hudson City Hall. The Lois Pair performs at the Dreamaway Lodge in Beckett, Massachusetts on Friday. Saturday, the Mountaintop Arboretum has an invasive species lecture. That's from 10 a.m. to noon up in Tannersville with Mark Whitmore from Cornell University. He's a forest entomologist there, talking about the best latest news about invasive species in our area. The Hudson River Exchange has a summer market from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Henry Hudson Riverfront Park Saturday, June 25th. Jack Waldman is playing at the Dreamway Lodge in Beckett, Massachusetts, Saturday, June 25th. And Don Byron is at Club Helsinki in Hudson on Saturday, June 25th. Finally, WGXC has an emergency fundraising dance party Saturday night at the Half Moon in Hudson at 9 p.m. So far confirmed are DJs Neva, Alex Benson, Chris Bishop, but there will be others. Please come out to the Half Moon in Hudson to benefit WGXC. That's at 48 South Front Street, across from the Amtrak station, from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. Saturday, June 25th. You can also hear it live on the FM signal on WGXC.org and 90.7 FM. I'm Tom Rowe. Thanks for listening to All Together Now. Tonight's song of the day is The Cuckoo Bird from Tom Carter, who performs June 23rd at the Half Moon in Hudson. That's Thursday, June 23rd, tonight at the Half Moon in Hudson, Tom Carter. Thank you. WGXC is pleased to announce that as of 2 p.m. this afternoon, WGXC reached its spring $20,000 fundraising goal and live programming has returned to 90.7 FM. WGXC extends its immense thanks to everyone who contributed during the extended drive. The outpouring of support was extraordinary. A big thank you to WGXC programmers, past and present, volunteers and supporters who made it happen. Whether pitching for support, providing incentive premiums or sustenance, answering phones or hitting the streets to solicit pledges in person, thank you from WGXC.